This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week. Carnival Corporation will sail from Miami to Cuba May 1st, and Cuban Americans can be on board. According to the official Cuban government newspaper today, the country has changed its policy and will allow anyone born in Cuba to come back into the country by merchant vessel or by cruise ship. Now, since at least the 1970s, Cuba had banned any Cubans from returning to their country via the water. Carnival Corporation's Fathom Cruise Line will set sail from Port Miami for Cuba May 1st with Cuban Americans on board. We'll begin the Florida Roundup quickly with this story here, and Tim Padgett covering Latin America for WLRN. We'll have a lot more details on this coming up here, but how significant of a change is this, what was announced here on Friday morning, Tim?
Very big. If you could pass the salt, I'd like to sprinkle a little on the crow I'm eating right now.
Yes.
I personally thought it would snow in Havana before Cuba ever changed this rule. And in a column this week for WLRN.org, I took Carnival to task for betting that it would, precisely because this was something Miami's Cuban exile community wanted and had been clamoring loudly for. And you very rarely, if ever, see the Cuban communist regime swallow its pride and make a concession like that to the exiles. But they did, and I was wrong. But I'm actually quite happy to be wrong in this case, because this signals some welcome flexibility on Cuba's part that makes the process of normalizing U.S.-Cuba ties look a little more hopeful today.
This may have been surprising to anybody outside the executive ranks at Carnival Corporation or its outside counsel.
Right. In my column this week, I said, you know, unless Carnival knows something the rest of us don't, it'll be a long time before their ships start sailing to Cuba. Well, obviously, they did know something we didn't know.
It was just this week that they essentially said, we're going to postpone this trip from Miami to Havana, scheduled May 1st, unless Cuba reverses course on this policy.
Go back and look at its statement, though. Last week, they announced they were delaying it pending. A corporation and their lawyers usually don't use language like that unless perhaps they are confident that they're going to see some sort of change. So maybe we shouldn't be so surprised. But still, this is very surprising, even if it wasn't that surprising to Carnival.
And it's not just Carnival, to be clear here. This is a broader policy. It's applicable to all cruise ships, perhaps even ferry ships now.
Oh, no, precisely. I mean, this opens the door to any kind of maritime arrival by people born in Cuba, and that's a big change.
It is a big change. How about you, South Florida? Do you support this change in Cuban policy? Do you give credit to Carnival for this change? How does the change perhaps change how you see the economic engagement going on between the United States and Cuba? Line up those calls now. We're going to return to this topic in a matter of moments. Here's the phone number, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Let us know on social media what you think about this change in Cuba. Greeting you on this Friday at WLRN on Twitter, and look for us on Facebook as well. We'll return to Carnival and Cuba, and we'll go to Havana as well to hear how this change in policy is being greeted and playing in Havana coming up in just a few moments. First, though, the cost of health care. No more surprise health care bills in Florida. There's a new law now designed to stop some patients from getting a surprise bill. That law goes into effect July 1st. The law aims to stop what's called balanced billing. It's a practice that can lead to a patient having to pay for medical care delivered by doctors outside their insurance networks, even when the care was done at an in-network facility. It's an effort to bring some clarity, or at least protection, for patients and what they pay for medical care. Now, Florida Governor Rick Scott has said last fall, in fact, that he wants to bring more transparency to health care costs.
Food's a necessity. Do you know what you pay for food? Absolutely. Before you buy it, you know exactly what you pay. If you're going to buy a car, you know what you're going to pay for a car. If you're going to buy a house, you know what you're going to pay for a house. Shouldn't you know exactly what you're going to have to pay for health care?
Now, health care costs certainly are complex, and they're often secret. How complex? Well, listen to what Republican State Representative Kerry Pigman said in January. Pigman ought to know. Pigman's an emergency medicine doctor in addition to being a state lawmaker.
I'm really thrilled at this growing realization that billed is one number, charged is another, collected is yet another, cost base is yet another. We're beginning to appreciate that these are all quite separate from one another.
Steve Ullman is from the University of Miami's Business School, and he compares healthcare pricing to Chinese takeout. Listen.
Let's say I want to get some Mugu Gai Pan. And Mugu Gai Pan, it runs at the takeout places I go to, about $10 for a large order. When you look at the price variation for something like ultrasound, with 47 providers, 47 Chinese restaurants, the range in price would be then equivalent to between $10 and $175 for Mugu Gai Pan.
WLRN, along with our partners WUSF in Tampa and Health News Florida, has launched Price Check this week. This is a reporting project aimed at bringing some clarity to the cost of health care in South Florida. You can help us untangle health care prices by using our new Price Check tool to upload your prices and see what other people paid. It's all online at WLRN.org/pricecheck. Our lead reporter on the project is Sammy Mack, joining us here on the Florida Roundup. Jeannie Pender is the founder and CEO of Clear Health Costs, our technology partner in this project. Sammy, will this project, will Price Check, bring transparency to healthcare in South Florida?
Well, if enough people collaborate and give us their information about what they paid, theoretically, yeah, it could. But in the interim, because this stuff is so complicated and there's actually a lot of disagreement around what transparency even means in healthcare, what we're trying to do is get enough information about what people are paying to start to understand what some of the influences are on the marketplace here.
Jeannie, so if there's disagreement about transparency, is there going to be disagreement about what a price paid is?
Yeah, well, it's interesting that you should ask that. We feel like you should know what stuff costs. So we as journalists survey providers on their cash or self-pay prices for 30 or so common shoppable procedures. What would you pay as an uninsured person? And from a range of providers in the Miami and Tampa Bay areas on things like an MRI, a cardio stress test, a CBC blood test, IUD, shoppable things like that.
So how does this work? How does this tool work? What's behind the scenes with the technology?
Yeah, so we load the database with the prices that we've collected from this range of providers, and then we make it really easy for you to share your prices. What you were charged, what insurance paid, what you paid, and also there's a box for how did you feel about it.
Hmm.
You can give us your email if you want to so we can reach back to you and look at your EOB. And then you see your figures in context with other people's figures and with those cash prices.
Sammy, there's plenty of other transparency tools out there. Most of the major health insurance companies have a transparency tool. Some big employers will have their own transparency tools. What's different about Price Check?
Well, what's different about Price Check is that when you look at the transparency tools that insurance companies have, for example, you can access the information about what gets paid on your behalf, but you have to be a member. And what we're doing is we're asking people to tell us those numbers, which is data that they own as patients who have had this paid on their behalf. And we'll be able to look sort of across platforms, across payers and insurers and all of that. Because what happens frequently is that negotiated rate, so what actually gets paid, not what gets charged, but like what actually gets paid on your behalf, is kept behind a non-disclosure agreement mm-hmm. between the provider, so the hospital or the doctor's office or the big group, and the insurance company. And that is where we have, as journalists, run into kind of a roadblock in terms of understanding what things truly cost in the system and what's driving those costs. So hopefully we can get enough of that information that that we'll be able to tell really meaningful stories out of it that we haven't had access to before.
Jeannie, about 30% of healthcare spending is done at hospitals. Why focus on specific line item charges, specific encounters, services, as opposed to kind of the total bill of an encounter?
So we're interested in total costs too, but because those hospital experiences, like for example, gallbladder surgery or something like that, has multiple entries in it, we're focusing on things that are very clearly apples to apples. An MRI of the lower back without contrast, CPT code 72148. You can compare that to
way out in the weeds there, but those numbers are all important, yeah.
So to make sure that we're comparing apples to apples, that we have these sort of consistent procedures that we could compare, a well woman exam, an IUD, an ultrasound, so that we know that we don't have things that have multiple entries in it, like a surgical experience, as you mentioned, could be very complicated.
And the other thing that I want to add to that, too, is there's been this effort by the Florida Hospital Association to create a transparency tool that looks at the average charges and the average prices paid for all sorts of things that happen inside the hospital.
The 50 kind of most popular, most common medical procedures and encounters in a hospital situation,
yeah,
where hospitalization is taken into account.
Yeah, and that is a lot of people were really excited about that as kind of an opening start. But because it's hospitals, it's the stuff that you stay overnight for. So the really common stuff isn't in there. So this is, again, like another way of getting at data that just isn't out there for people to look at this way.
Because, Jeannie, if hospitals account for about 30% of our healthcare dollar in terms of where we spend it, another 30% is spent on doctors and doctor services and visits. Where does PriceCheck encounter this kind of relationship that healthcare patients have with doctors?
So what's interesting about patients entering the healthcare marketplace is once you say, "Doc, how much is this going to cost?" Quite often the answer is, "We don't know. We can't tell you. You'll have to wait until we send it through the insurance company." We don't think that's right. We think all the prices should be public all the time. All the charge prices, the cash prices, what your out-of-pocket is going to be before you enter a common procedure.
Doesn't this allow the facilities that are on the higher end of those charges, or perhaps the facilities that are in the lower end of the charges, be able to raise their prices, knowing that others in the market are getting paid maybe 50%, 60%, 70% more than they are?
Well, what we found is quite the opposite. When prices are public, those high-end, the recipients of high-end payments actually get kind of embarrassed and ask if they could please not be publicly shamed for having really high prices.
That experience, because you've done this price check program in San Francisco, you've done it in Philadelphia. What are the lessons that you've seen early on from those pioneer projects, and any early trends you've been able to pick up in the database you've constructed already for South Florida?
The biggest trend I think I would say is that people are really upset about healthcare pricing and they want answers. They also want to contribute to a solution. We've learned that people are really eager to put their healthcare information online, which was a total surprise when we started out doing this. And we're really happy as journalists to join hands with our communities on these efforts. As far as early trends in the Florida data, you guys, Florida, you have really, really, really low MRI prices. Like, we should all be flying down to Florida to have our MRIs. It's that much cheaper.
Is that a function of competition, of the number of MRI facilities that are available?
I expect that we will figure out and write a great story about it. What's up with that, Florida?
Yeah, indeed. What is up with that? Well, if you've got an MRI price you want to contribute, you can do so. With all the privacy concerns applied there at WLRN.org/price check. You know, and we just launched this on Thursday, and we got an email from Sue in Miami spelling this situation out and asking a question here. And I want to put it to both of you, Sammy and Jeannie. Sue wrote us, "Healthcare providers now ask for a credit card upfront to either charge what they estimate the patient's responsibility will be or hold until after the insurance processes the claim. I was told if I didn't pay upfront or leave a credit card on file, I couldn't have the procedure done. I don't like the idea of leaving my credit card open for a doctor or facility to charge whatever amount they decide at a later time. Why is this trend happening?" Jeannie, any answers for Sue?
I think what we're seeing is that there's a lot of chaos in the marketplace, and because of high deductibles, providers are having a hard time collecting either the deductible or the copay or coinsurance. I will say that Sue is not alone. I have a friend who went to a doctor's office in the great state of Florida, was asked that very same question, give us your credit card first. We can't tell you how much we're going to charge. And she said, sorry, and walked out.
Jeannie Pender is our technology partner on this project. She is the founder and CEO of Clear Health Costs, joining us from New York City. Sammy Mack, our project reporter on this effort with us right here on WLRN. WLRN.org/price check. This program, this project will continue through at least the end of this calendar year. It is a crowdsourced effort looking at healthcare prices in the state of Florida. This is not the last time. Of course, we'll be talking about it here on the Florida Roundup. Thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Thanks
for having us.
Still to come, we will return to Carnival, sailing to Cuba, and Cuban Americans now welcome on board. That and your input next on the Florida Roundup. We're back on the Florida Roundup. I'm Tom Hudson on WLRN. Thanks again for listening this week. It began this week with Carnival Corp threatening to delay the planned first cruise ship trip between Miami and Cuba in more than 50 years if Cuba did not change an immigration policy. Well, the week is ending on this Friday with Cuba changing said policy. It has reversed its decades-old rule and will allow anyone born in Cuba to return to the island on a merchant ship or on a cruise ship. So this opens the way for Carnival's Fathom cruise brand to set sail for Cuba on May 1st as originally scheduled. In a conference call with reporters this morning, Carnival Corp CEO Arnold Donald was asked if he thought what he thought persuaded Cuban leaders to allow cruise ships and merchant ships to travel with Cuban-born citizens on board.
My opinion is simply that once they decided to accept cruise as a contributor to the people exchange and, you know, additional economic development, that, you know, they also realized, you know, having a disparity between air travel and cruise could be an inhibitor.
So do you support Carnival in its efforts? Has it opened the door for more capitalism, more commerce between South Florida and Cuba? Are you booking passage as a Cuban American now allowed to enter your native-born country via ship? Let us know here as we're back to the issue of Carnival and Cuba. 800-743-WLRN. Line up the calls now. 800-743-9576. Social media at WLRN and on Facebook as well. Tim Padgett, WLRN's America's reporter, back with us. And Patrick Obman, CNN Havana correspondent, with us from Havana. Patrick, let's begin with you on the island. How is the Cuban government explaining this change to its citizenry on the island?
Well, we had a front page piece in Granma, the Communist Party Daily, the state-run newspaper. There's only state-run media that's available to the public here. And they said it's mutually beneficial to both governments, which in short means more cash for the economy here, which is badly needed. And the government here has seen for many years now, ever since the fall of the Soviet Union, that tourism is going to be a key factor for them. It's a country with beaches. And now more and more it's U.S. tourism. So this is a change that they just had to make, and it was really a policy that even Cuban officials wouldn't even defend. It was something that was just so outdated and very, very unpopular, as you can imagine, to see if you're a foreigner here, you can get on a boat fairly easily. If you're a Cuban, it's next to impossible. So yeah, this is the beginning of a long-awaited change.
Yeah, and I would add that if you were reading the Grandma article this morning, they also tried to make it sound like this was not just a reversal done in the past few days, that this was a long evolution of policy, that this is something they had been thinking about. I don't know if that was the impression you got as well, Patrick, reading that, but it seemed like they were doing a little bit of face-saving in that regard.
Any evidence of that, Patrick? I mean, there was a statement out of Carnival on Monday saying it was going to delay this cruise pending a change in the Cuban policy, and here we are 4 days later, and that change is a reality.
Absolutely, and certainly Carnival was lobbying the Cuban government, trying to explain why this looks so bad for them on a PR standpoint. And of course, the Cuban government is not going to say that they caved to pressure from the Cuban American community of all places.
Exactly.
But I think it was a realization that they are going to have to change certain policies if they want to do business with companies, U.S. companies. And that is something that we haven't seen here a lot. Up until now, it's sort of been a my way or the highway.
Yeah.
You're lucky to be able to do business here. But I think Carnival is an 800-pound gorilla, and they obviously have engaged the Cuban government in a way where they're able to get their points across. And, you know, there are lots of laws here that are very unpopular, don't make sense, and have stayed on the books. And to see the Cuban government backtrack on anything is pretty significant.
Patrick, I want to ask you about the optics of that. It's not just, you know, that Cuban officials have reversed this particular policy. It's not just that they've reversed it in regards to a large American cruise ship. It's that they've reversed it in regards to a Miami-based cruise ship operator, a Fortune 500 cruise ship operator with 10 cruise brands, a global presence. Did that play into the political calculations, do you think, that the Communist Party had to go through and the twists and turns, maybe, that is logic in explaining this policy change to its own supporters?
Anything that has all those elements you just described makes it much more complicated. But, you know, European cruises have been coming here for years, and they had the same prohibition on European cruises. I've heard from Cubans who live in Europe who wanted to come on.
Sure.
And those companies
to the point they could have changed this with any of those European providers allowing Cuban-born Italians, Cuban Italians, Cuban Spaniards to come back.
The difference being Cubans in Madrid don't go out and protest as angrily as we saw Miami Cuban Americans demonstrate against this policy.
We're talking here about the change announced out of Havana, allowing Cuban-born Americans, anybody born in Cuba who wants to return to that island can do so now via cruise ship, via merchant ship, reversing a decades-old policy and opening the way now for the first commercial cruise between United States and Cuba in more than 50 years. This is the Carnival situation we've been talking about now for a good couple of weeks. How about it? You ready to book passage now? Do you support, do you give props to Carnival for opening up this kind of economic activity and this people-to-people exchange? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Patrick Oppmann, CNN Havana correspondent, still with us from Havana. What other barriers are there for Cuban Americans wanting to book passage? Are there additional costs that continue to be in the way, additional visas, additional other kind of hurdles that the government has yet to address?
You know, we'll just have to see how it plays out, because there's what the Cuban government says, and a lot of times there's different realities. You know, Cubans coming by plane, once you land here, Cuba is a country that doesn't recognize dual nationality. So if you were born in Cuba, you are Cuban, even if you've lived in the U.S. All your life. So that means you have to go and apply for a Cuban passport, which can take a long time. It involves getting documents from the island, which can be expensive and very complicated. So there's just a different set of rules. It appears with the cruise ships, they're going to make it easier for Cubans to come back. And I think they expect a lower volume. Obviously, cruise ships are very expensive, much more expensive than coming here by air.
Yeah.
And where you go to the Havana airport, and it's just full of Cuban Americans returning. We'll have to see how many people choose to come by cruise ship. But apparently, some people are interested in doing it, and now they'll be able to.
800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN, line one in Miami. Ray is joining the program. Ray, go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. A comment and a question. I see this as a parallel to what happened with the Iron Curtain when, yes, it was Reagan who said, tear the wall down, Gorbachev, but it was years before that of capitalism really affecting the way people act and behave inside of the Soviet Union. And here I see the same thing. This is something that we should really applaud President Obama for, allowing commerce to start getting into Cuba, because the pressures that business will bear on the Cuban government will make changes. And this is just one example, and I applaud Carnival. The question I have is, what do you think is going to be the response from really the right-wing element that still believes that the embargo should be still in place? Because the way I see it, it's been a 50-year failure, and I think this is the right way to go. But what is your opinion on how the right-wing element here in this country is going to respond to Carnival's push? Thank you very much.
Well, I think so far the more conservative faction that Ray is talking about has been, their reaction has been a little muted, because I do think that they realize that what happened this morning sort of flies in the face of their criticism that normalization was in a rut, that it was a bust for the U.S. because all we were doing was giving and giving in terms of concessions to Cuba, and they were giving nothing in return.
Would you describe this as the most significant concession on the part of the Cuban government since the easing of relations began in December of 2014?
I don't know if it's the most significant concession, but it's a big one in the sense that what you had, for example, at the Cuban Communist Party Congress this week, yep, and that Patrick, I'm sure, was covering, was a lot of communist hardliners in Cuba retrenching. And they were making it clear that they didn't want to yield anything to Los Yankees, especially after Obama had come there last month and publicly challenged them to embrace more democratic and economic reform, which is what makes this so surprising. One thing you have to remember, though, is during that Congress, Raul Castro, the president of Cuba, himself stood up and said, we are stuck in an obsolete mentality economically here.
He called it an attitude of inertia.
Exactly. And it looks like Raul then won out at the end of this week.
Let's go back to the phones here on the Florida Roundup. Michael is joining us from Key West. Go ahead, Michael. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yes, my name is Michael Larson, and I'm calling because I'm a sailboat racer. And my friend Vianney Navarrete in Miami, I've been sailing with him for since the 80s. And we were participating in the SORC series this winter, and we were not allowed to participate in the Miami to Havana race, which is one of that series, because Vianney was born in Cuba, and now he's a U.S. citizen. Mm-hmm. And I came late to the program today, and I was wondering if the policy applies to private boats, like sailboats, and if, yep. for example, my friend Vianney can now participate in these races or sail his boat to Cuba.
Michael, it's a great question. Let's put that to Patrick Ottman, who is a CNN's Havana correspondent with us in Havana. One of the interesting things that we were discussing a week ago when this policy was still in play, Patrick, was that the policy made no discernment between type of vessel. It was that Cuban-born folks could not come back to the island via the water. Are there any clarifications in this reversal of policy here?
Yes, and they've said this will eventually apply to yachts and private vessels. Not right now. The cruise boat change will come into effect next week. Really, it seems like it was done specifically for the Carnival line ship that'll be here on May 2nd. And they've said that they're, as part of their changes on migration, you know, trying to make it look like this is not just a one-off, but a larger change to how Cubans are able to come in and out of the country, that it will eventually apply to private vessels. As of right now, if you are Cuban and you try to get on a boat that's at the Hemingway Marina here, they do not let you. If you try to come in, they do not let you. But what they've said is they realize that that policy doesn't make any sense. And that it will eventually go away, but they haven't given specifics on when that will take place.
And I would add just quickly, I think the more important consideration here is ferry service, because as Patrick said, you're not going to see a lot of Cuban Americans taking cruises as opposed to the number that go on charter flights, for example. But the ferry services is a much quicker and more practical way for them to go. And to see that change, to let ferries, Cuban Americans go on ferries, will be very important.
Patrick,
of course,
go ahead.
Sorry, Cuban Americans will be able to bring more goods with them.
Exactly. Yeah.
On ferries.
Exactly.
And that's
mm-hmm.
one of the big drivers right now of all over Havana. You're seeing certain areas getting fixed up, really block to block, house to house, and all those goods are coming in on the charters right now. And if you allow ferry service, and this seems like it's laying the way eventually for ferry service down the road, but big question is just the infrastructure. Carnival's not coming here with one of their bigger cruises because they don't fit.
They don't fit into the harbor because the harbor isn't
correct.
Deep enough.
There isn't the infrastructure.
To Patrick, to Michael's question regarding the sailboat, though, right now that sailor, a Cuban-born American sailor, would still not be allowed to set foot on the island if they arrive via their sailboat.
That's correct.
Yeah.
But what's changed is they've been with the announcement today, the government said we will scrap this policy, and it's a policy that's been around as long as anybody can really remember.
And is it your sense, Patrick, they're going to scrap it for vessels of all sizes, or it's going to be 100-meter yachts or above, or 40-meter yachts or above?
They haven't specified that, but they basically have said pleasure craft, yachts, and it seems like any boat that would be able to make the trip from the U.S., it just would no longer apply. A lot of this has to do with illegal migration.
Sure,
as well.
Of course.
But certainly, the laws that they have on the books now, even though it's really not a law, it's just a policy. You can't find what the actual policy is. It's not written down anywhere. But the policy as it is hasn't stopped illegal migration. So I think the Cuban government has finally realized it's both unpopular and totally ineffective.
Let's go to Tamarack, where Joanne is joining the Florida Roundup. Joanne, go ahead.
Yes, hi, good morning. Good afternoon, sorry. If someone can just please explain to me, why is the Cuban government so resistant to the change for tourism? It seems to me that this would be a win-win situation for everyone, and it would help the country economically. I mean, yes, we want to do away with the embargo as far as President Obama is concerned, but it seems to me that it takes a lot for the Cuban government to get there. So why is there such a resistance? Thank you.
Joanne, thanks for the question. Tim's going to handle that one.
Well, I think the big reason is you have to put yourself inside the head of Cuban officials. They tend, this is a communist government that doesn't tend to approach these matters with the same sort of business frame of mind that we would as Americans. They look at things first from the political standpoint rather than the economic standpoint. And so the political consideration here was sort of first in their minds. And but then I think what began to happen was that they started to realize they were going to be losing all these millions of dollars in hard currency that come from docking fees, disembarking passengers, supplies purchases every time one of these cruise ships docks in. They need that hard currency terribly. It's a severely cash-strapped economy in Cuba. So that practicality that you're talking about, Joanne, finally won out over the political considerations that usually win out in Cuba.
Tim Padgett covering the Americas for us here at WLRN. Patrick Oppmann is CNN's Havana correspondent with us from the island. Patrick, thank you for your time today, and we appreciate your input there here on the Florida Roundup. We want to go from Cuba and its treatment of Cubans returning to the island to the U.S. treatment of immigrants here. This week in Washington, the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments in a lawsuit filed by 25 states, including Florida, against President Obama's executive actions expanding two programs designed to delay deporting certain undocumented immigrants, specifically kids who entered the U.S. and parents of U.S. citizens. Now, during most immigration debates, undocumented workers are commonly thought to be low-wage workers laboring in the shadows of the economy. But a Sun Sentinel-published investigation this week explores what it calls the prosperous but undocumented. The article features South Florida residents who are really living the American dream here in South Florida, but without proper documents. They're homeowners, working professionals, taxpayers, and they face deportation at any time. Miriam Valverde is the Sun Sentinel business reporter behind the investigation. She joins us now from our Doral studios. Miriam, this is a really interesting look into a different type of undocumented worker. Not unfamiliar here in South Florida, though. Tell us a little bit about these prosperous but undocumented. How long, for instance, have they been living here, and how have they been able to be prosperous without being documented?
Sure, and thank you for having me. We have individuals, who have been here in the U.S. for 18 years, as is the case of Kelsey Burke, a woman from Honduras who came when she was 10 years old to the United States. She is now 28 and a lawyer. We also have a couple from Argentina who came in 2001, and they're now business owners. They also own their home. And we have a family from Venezuela who came 3 years ago. They left Venezuela fleeing political threats, and now they have applied for asylum and hope to, you know, build a new life here.
And how have they gone about building that life in South Florida? Certainly a community of immigrants. We're very familiar with the immigrant story, be it either from Cuba or from Argentina or from Venezuela. But there's a difference between that story and home ownership and private business practices and all the kind of licensing and regulations that can be involved with essentially becoming legit.
Definitely. And it hasn't been easy. I mean, compared to the typical or the stereotypical undocumented immigrant, they do tend to live somewhat better than that population. Yet they also struggle, and they do go through lots of loops to be able to get where they are now. For instance, the lawyer we profiled, Kelsey Burke, she had to lobby to lawmakers essentially to allow her and other undocumented immigrants to be able to be admitted to the Florida bar. Laws had to be passed so that she and others could practice law. Wilfredo Noguera, the accountant we spoke to, he has applied for asylum. His case has been pending for 3 years. And while his case is pending, he is able to work. He has a work permit, although if his case for asylum is denied, he could be deported. And so he feels that in a way he's in limbo. He says, you know, I'm not illegal, but I'm not legal either. So things could change any moment for them. And as far as Mauro Kennedy and his wife, Maria Bilbao, business owners, they register their business. They said, you know, to register a business, you don't need to show immigration status. You file the paperwork with the state, pay your dues, pay your taxes, business fees, and then you're good to go. There's no need to show that you have a visa or U.S. citizenship or permanent residency.
Miriam, how many of the folks that you spoke to feel that they're living in the shadows of the economy? I mean, the types of jobs that you highlight with this prosperous but undocumented series are not day laborers in farm fields in South Dade County, certainly. These are, you know, white-collar working professionals, highly educated, advanced degrees in some cases.
Right. They do feel that in a way they're, you know, trying to stand out and make a name for themselves. They've decided to become activists in some ways. They feel they need to control the narrative when it comes to immigration and the undocumented population. And they, Kelsey Burke, for instance, she's been an advocate for reform, as has Mauro Kennedy and Maria Bilbao. They're out there on the streets. They put their faces out there on TV, and they show that undocumented immigrants are also contributing to the economy, be it through their jobs, paying taxes, property taxes, sales tax, income tax. They file their taxes using ITIN numbers. For instance, Mauro and Maria Kennedy, they have years worth of tax payments that they've made. Even though they cannot get a refund, they still make their tax contributions.
And Miriam, what's your sense as to how, to what extent this is going to influence the Supreme Court's ultimate decision? We saw, for example, there was a lot of fear on the part of those who oppose President Obama's immigration policy that Justice Roberts, for example, who could be the deciding vote on this, was listening to evidence just like what you've been describing, and in the absence of any evidence that illegal migrants are really that much of a drain on our economy, he would rather defer to letting the executive branch follow its rights to set these kinds of policies. Do you think that this kind of evidence that you're describing is going to help push the Supreme Court's decision in that direction?
It's a possibility. And at the same time, these immigrants, they're out there. We have even Maria Bilbao, one of the immigrants we profiled, she's been in Washington advocating for reform. And what they're saying out loud is that we're here, we're paying taxes, we're contributing, and we want to do more, even more for the economy. Should we be allowed to legalize our status? Once, for instance, the Argentinian couple, that's what they say. They say once we have a permanent residency, we would want to expand our business. We want to be able to employ workers, buy more equipment for their business. They are in the private contractors remodeling homes throughout South Florida, yet they feel they could employ people to help them grow their business. They can provide more for the economy should they have that chance, and they hope their voices are heard and that the Supreme Court goes in their favor.
Miriam, on the flip side, though, there are those that would like to see tighter immigration laws and would read these stories that you've published in the Sun Sentinel about prosperous but undocumented, and saying there are loopholes here. Registering a business, for instance, doesn't require an immigration status. Maybe that's a loophole that ought to be closed. There are loopholes regarding IRS tax payments. Maybe there ought to be some immigration checks and balances along with that, to be able to see the prosperous but undocumented. How would they respond to that?
Right. And that's another argument they make as well. They say no matter what your employment status is here, no matter what you do, they say you're breaking the law, you're here undocumented, you should not be here, period. So they do feel that if it's more of a legal situation, then, deport them. Doesn't matter what they're doing or how much they're contributing. The fact is that if they are here undocumented,
right,
then they should not get a pass.
Miriam Valverde is the lead reporter, Sun Sentinel business reporter, on their series Prosperous But Undocumented, published this week as the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in a lawsuit filed by 25 states, including the state of Florida, against two of President Obama's executive actions regarding immigration. Tim Padgett covering the Americas for us here at WLRN. Miriam, Tim, thanks again for joining us here on the Florida
Roundup. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you.
Still to come on our program, 1 week after a fatal tiger attack on a zookeeper, what do we know about what happened behind the scenes at the Palm Beach Zoo? That's next as the Roundup continues. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.
What is wrong? Okay, for now, I would like for you to please send the paramedics to the Palm Beach Zoo. Can you please confirm that you're doing that at this time? I'm going to be getting more information.
This was the 911 call made 1 week ago, Friday afternoon.
No,
I need to know what's wrong with the patient before I can even start anyone. I need
again,
to
know. I know this call is recorded. I'm noting the time. Please send paramedics at this time. I'm gathering information.
The call was from the Palm Beach Zoo, where we now know a zookeeper had been attacked by a tiger. But the 911 caller didn't know or wouldn't tell the operator what had happened.
I have other job duties as well, so once you're done with me, let me know.
I can't. I need to find out just a little bit more information.
I don't have any additional information. It's impossible for me to get any additional information at this time, unfortunately, but we definitely need paramedics. It's
okay,
a tiger, and it's a person. Okay, thank you.
I understand. And wait a minute,
The zookeeper, 37-year-old Stacy Conweiser, was mauled by an endangered tiger. The animal was tranquilized, and first responders say they had to wait for the drugs to take effect on the animal before they could get near the zookeeper. Now, the medical examiner's report says she died of a broken neck, provided no further information pending additional reports. This attack happened outside of public view, and the zoo has taken a lot of criticism over the past week about the handling of the situation, as has the media for naming the tiger involved. John Pacente is a reporter at the Palm Beach Post. He's along with us via Skype, along with his colleague, Hannah Winston, also with the Palm Beach Post. Now, we did reach out to the zoo's communication director, as well as several members of the Zoological Society of the Palm Beach's board, asking them to participate. They did not respond to our inquiries. John, let's begin. The status of the investigation. There's a state investigation and a federal investigation here. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And what's the status of those? Do we know anything about the timeline they're operating under?
We understand that these investigations can take months, you know, before they're complete. And the zoo is saying that they're not going to really explain how Stacy died until those investigations are complete. However, if you look at other tiger attacks, like the one last year in New Zealand or the one in Miami 20 years ago, by this time, even you know, a week after the incident, we knew exactly what had happened.
Hannah, in this case, what do we know what happened? Has there been any official police report released, we've got a medical exam report of the cause of death? Have we seen any other kind of autopsy reports, anything along those lines?
No, I mean, everything is still, just as you ask questions, we do too. All that we do know is that she was in the area where the tigers were sleeping and where they're fed when they're not out on exhibit. She was getting ready for a tiger talk, so she was going in to grab meat or something else. Whenever it happened during that period of time, the tiger was out or got out and attacked her. But between the attack and the 911 call, we have no idea what happened at this point. And the zoo has been very, very closed as far as letting us know anything beyond that.
Do we know if there's any video potentially that investigators could look at, or any audio of the attack itself?
Well, on Saturday, I did ask if the area was under surveillance, and the zoo spokeswoman said it was. Now, whether that the attack was caught on video or not, that's still up in the air. Mm-hmm. The statement they gave out yesterday saying they were still compiling facts gave us pause, you know, wondering if, in fact, that they still don't know how the tiger was able to get to Stacy. At this point, there are more questions than answers.
So let's talk about the space that this happened in. This is not in the open zoo where the public would have been able to see it. This is what's been called, a night box, a night cage, a night space, something
like
that?
A night house.
A night house. But even that, it's been explained to me by other zoo professionals outside of the Palm Beach Zoo, the night house is kind of a misnomer. It's not just used at night. This is traditionally the space behind the scenes where the animals are fed and can go and nap in some cases.
Correct. And so at that point, that's why it's a little confusing how the tiger had gotten out or anything, because once someone is in there, there's one or two doors to get in, and then there are four separate cages from the blueprints that I was looking at. The mother's den for the females up there, and then the other ones for the other three tigers. And that is where the keepers will go in, and they're kept, not necessarily overnight, but if they're not out on exhibit, they kept in there because tigers are solitary animals. They like to stay alone, essentially. They're not out there in couples unless they're breeding or anything. So they're kept in there, and they're fed, the areas are clean, they sleep there. But then there are other opportunities for them. One of the things they said, it wasn't open to the public, when in fact, they allowed these kind of behind-the-scenes tours for public for an extra fee during that time. Mm. Whether or not there were any that day, we don't know, but they did, up until that point, allow the public and schools and so forth to come back into that area.
Do we know if a tour was going on at the time of this attack on Friday afternoon last week?
Well, it would have. As far as we know, they looked like they were only earlier in the day, and the time frame around when this attack happened was around 1:30, 2 o'clock between then, and it doesn't seem like that. From our understanding, what from the zoo has told us, it was Stacy back there, and she was getting ready for a tiger talk, which had been away from all of that.
Hannah
Whether or not she was with another keeper is still under question.
Hannah Winston is a reporter at the Palm Beach Post. Her colleague John Pacinti along with us as well, talking about the fatal tiger attack at the Palm Beach Zoo a week ago today. A tiger keeper Stacy Kahnweiser mauled and killed by this tiger. Let's talk about the response at the event itself. The tiger tranquilized, not killed. The zoo has defended that decision. How and why, John, can we understand the policy that was in play here where the zoo used the tranquilizer gun as opposed to any kind of fatal force against the tiger?
Well, of course, we don't know what the condition of Stacy was at the time they made this decision.
Right.
But they said that if they would have used a gun to shoot the tiger, that it might have ricocheted, it might have shot Stacy instead. But there's pros and cons to both. If tranquilizers, you don't know how long it's going to take effect.
Sure. John, let me ask you this question. We're just running short on time, but other zoos have told me on background that their kill teams, the so-called kill teams, are sometimes local law enforcement, that they're not kill teams that are on staff in the zoo. Do we know if the Palm Beach Zoo has a quote-unquote kill team for these types of code reds on premise, or would they have to wait for local law enforcement?
They haven't confirmed that, but at the Zoo Miami, they do have a kill team, and they take a routine, practice at gun ranges and are prepared to, kill an animal if needed.
John Pacinti, covering the fatal tiger attack at the Palm Beach Zoo for the Palm Beach Post, his colleague Hannah Winston along with us as well from the Palm Beach Post. To both of you joining us from Palm Beach County, thank you so much for your time and effort here on the Florida Roundup.
Thank you.
We will end our program this week on certainly a lighter note. We've been asking you to write something poetic about where you live here in the month of April. It's a zip ode, an ode to your zip code. It's, of course, part of the Poetry Festival in the month of April with Oh Miami. We want a 5-line poem about where you live, using the digits in your zip code to determine how many words per line.
Melody Santiago Cummings. This is my zip ode. Depending on your accent, it's sci-fi or super Latin sounding. El Portal, the big gate, my tiny village. 33138.
My name is Jessica Patton Pellegrino, and this is my zip ode. Tiki Hut Lunchroom. Teachers in flip-flops. School in Key West. 33040.
This is Jim Lowell with my zip ode. If you lose your balls in mangrove trim, you are cautioned against poking around, much to the saltwater crocodile's chagrin. 33149.
Celebrating the rough edges from Palm Beach County down to the Keys. The website's still open, by the way. You can submit your zip ode. We've got a zip ode generator for you online. Here's the website, wlrn.org/zip ode. It is poetry in paradise in the month of April. Thanks to all those folks that submitted their zip odes. That'll do it for the Florida Roundup this week. Let us know what you're talking about on Facebook. Look for our new Facebook group. It's facebook.com/group/theFloridaRoundup. The program is produced by Gina Jordan and Alicia Zuckerman. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Our program director is Peter J. Meritz. And our technical supervision by Mr. Paul Leary. Thank you, sir. I'm Tom Hudson. Have a wonderful weekend, and thanks for listening.